Our thoughts for today are entitled, I Will Come Again. And we find this in Matthew chapter 24, verse 3. This talk really has to talk about the expectation of the Lord's return. Now, where does that set in scriptures? When we look at John chapter 14, verse 3, Jesus himself tells us, I go and prepare a place for you. I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also. And so Jesus himself, by his very words to his disciples, was setting the expectation that although he was leaving, that he would return. In Job chapter 19, verse 25, we read, according to New International, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. He will come again. So this was the expectation even in the Old Testament, because they knew what was prophesied. In Acts chapter 1, verse 10, this according to New International, the Apostle Paul gives us some insights as well. Jesus, who has been taken from you into heaven, will come back. And so we see this theme by Jesus' own words, by the apostles' words, by prophecy in the Old Testament. So it's the setting the expectation that the Lord would return. What's the nature of the Lord's return, coming back? In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 1 and 6, this is kind of set up for us. And it gives us an awful lot of information. Here the Apostle Paul says, but of the times and seasons, brethren. Now let me just stop here. He's identifying exactly what his audience is. It's the brethren. It's not the world. It's not other people. It's those that he called brethren. And there's a specific purpose for this. This is information that only those who were of the brethren class would fully understand. He continues, you have no need that I write unto you. For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night. Now here he's painting a picture for us. And it's the picture of how a thief steals in under the cloak of darkness, steals things, and then disappears. So it wasn't going to be obvious. And if the lights are on, the thief doesn't come. But from all appearances, he comes in very quietly, very silently, and is not seen by the majority. That in that day should not overtake you as a thief. Let us watch and be sober. So he's telling these brethren that your job is to watch and be sober. Look carefully for the Lord's return. And that's exactly what's expected of the brethren class. And that's exactly what we should be doing. Why did the Lord return secretly? Why didn't he come boldly? We're kind of given some insights into this in Matthew chapter 24, verse 43, according to New International again. But understand this. If the owner of the house, you know that to be Satan in this picture, had known what time of night the thief, Christ, was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house to be broken into. And so it's telling us some very important information that even Satan himself is not aware of the details of when he would secretly return. So we said this is a secret, and yet, you know, if you look at Christianity, you're also expecting the coming of the Lord. So how is this veiled in the scriptures so that that brethren class can understand the details? In Matthew 24:3, we read, what shall be the sign of thy coming? Matthew 24:27, 37, and 39, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. 1 Corinthians 15:23, afterward they that are Christ at his coming. 1 Thessalonians 2:19, in the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ at his coming. And finally, in numerous places unto the coming of the Lord. So is there any question as to why Christendom is expecting a second, the Lord to come? No, the expectation's been set. Now what we notice about all of these verses is every one of them was quoted according to the King James Version. And this is very important to note. And this will help us understand how this is veiled so that they can see it and yet not necessarily understand it. Now when we look at the word that is translated coming in all of these prior cases, it's the word parousia, which when you look it up in Strong's, it says it's presence. Now is there a difference between presence and coming? Well yes, there is. And we'll look at some of the nuances with that. There are some other words that also are associated with the Lord's return, and that includes the word epiphania, which means bright shining, and apocalypto, which means revealment. So we're going to look at a little more detail at each and every one of these and show in Scripture how these are painting a picture in our minds. How is the Lord's return revealed? We're going to look at those same Scriptures, this time rendered according to Rotherham. And one of the wonderful things about Rotherham is he's much more precise with his language. And he wasn't influenced as much by the doctrine of the day to make it sound the way they wanted. And you'll notice in each of these instances, he rendered it what? The same way that Strong's did. He rendered it presence. And that's exactly what it should be. And so it changes the word significantly. What shall be the sign of thy presence? I'm present here. I'm not coming here. I'm present. Now, I came from lunch over into this building and arrived, but I'm present now in the same way that each of you are. So it's a significant difference. So as we look at this, we're saying, now what are the signs not of his coming, but of his presence? So the question is parousia coming or presence? And do we have anything in Scripture that can clarify that for us? I think that we do. And we find this in Philippians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. And I put the words up there, parousia and apousia, and you see the A prefix on it makes it the negative. And so could you render this anything other than, would this make sense if we said, not only in my coming, but also in my absence? That doesn't make sense. And so we see we've got the two characteristics here. It wouldn't make any sense in this context. And in fact, when we look, this is King James, they rendered it presence here because it didn't make sense to say not only in my coming, but much more in my absence. It doesn't make sense. And so we see here that the Scriptures actually confirm that these are essentially opposites. You're either present or you're absent. Now, Greek is a precise language. There are words for coming and there are words for present. And we need to understand it. We might just say, well, you know, they did it one way in one place because they didn't have another word for it. And is that the case? Well, there is a Greek word for coming. To come or arrive is perkamai. And it's a verb. Because it's an action word. You come into the building, and then you are present. We're given this in context, again, in Matthew 24. In Matthew 24, and you see Daniel 12, we're going to use a lot in this talk. It says, watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. That's the word they use there, perkamai. So it's not that they didn't have a word or that they weren't using it precisely. It says the translation in King James is not particularly good. And as such, it has helped veil that meaning. You know, nominal Christendom today thinks the Lord is coming. They know the signs are there. They accept the signs. They got the wrong word. those signs indicate not that he's coming, but that he is present. And parousia, of course, is presence, and that's a noun. In Matthew 24:37, we read, "For just as the days of Noah, so shall be the parousia, or presence, of the Son of Man." He's going to be present. And so one of those conditions, that really helps those that are of that brethren class interpret it properly and realize we're not talking about him coming, but being present when these signs are there. Now in Matthew 24:27, we're going to read it according to Rotherham, once again because of the precision. We're given a word picture here. You've got a word picture, you've also got a picture, and it's a picture of a sunrise. And as it says here, "For just as the lightning goeth forth from the east and shineth unto the west, so shall the presence of the Son of Man be." So it's giving us this analogy, and we know about this shining from east to west because that is what? Sunrise. And so we've given you a picture of sunrise, and we all have been up at sunrise at one time or another, and what you notice is you see distinctions, and you might know something's there, but you can't see any of the distinguishing features. And that's really the nature of this first phase of the presence. In Matthew 24:3 we read, "And what shall be the sign of thy presence and the conclusion of the age?" In other rendering, it's the end of the age. So it's that very key expression. And so they're saying that the first phase that we're going to talk about is one where we discern that something's changing, we're seeing light, but we can't make out all of the details. And so the Lord arrives, erkamai, and then he's present for a period of time. And what we would expect as we continue to develop this picture is you're going to see it's going to be progressively brighter and brighter and brighter. Just like the picture that he's painting here, which is the picture of sunrise. First you've just got darkness and light, and then we go to the next phase, the bright shining. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 8, we read, "Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me in that day, and not to me only, but unto all them that also love his appearing." This is that word epiphania, the bright shining, the second word that we use in context with the Lord's return. And so now as the sun begins to rise, the picture is painted. And now we start to distinguish features. Perhaps we see a silhouette or an object. And we start to distinguish what is happening. And so the bright shining comes. And so we add that on. This is a progressive picture. So first, there's something there, but we can't tell what it is. Next, those that love him at his appearing. So now they have a clearer picture, a clearer vision, and they continue. And then finally we have the revealment. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8, according to Rotherham, "And then shall be revealed," that's that apocalypto, "the lawless one." So now we're revealing unrighteousness. So it's shining and it's clear to everyone. "Whom the Lord will slay with the spirit of his mouth and paralyze with the bright shining," the fourth shining, "of his presence." And so in this one scripture, we see the combination of all of these. He had to be present. He started to be revealed with increasing brightness, and now that brightness is such that all see it, and it, what? Reveals all unrighteousness. And so this is the picture that the scriptures And so we add in that the revealment. And what we would expect is over time the evidence would increase. So we're talking about a process here, and it starts very dim and then gets very bright to where all is revealed. Is that what we find? Is that an authorized picture? Well, let's look a little further. As we've noted, when you look at prophetic fulfillments, they often start very small and grow very large. And I'm reminded of the redwoods. If you've ever been to the redwoods out in California, you go out there, and normally what you do is you say, "I'd like to take a redwood pine cone." So you pick up the big white pine cone that's there, And the ranger tells you, no, it's this little tiny pine cone. So the tiniest seed grows to be the largest living organism on earth. And that's exactly the way prophetic fulfillment is. It starts with very modest seeds. So oftentimes we look for big, giant events, and we don't see them. And we say, well, it must not have come true. But in fact, we have to look a little farther. And we have to look for small beginnings that grow. And that's right in line with this picture that we've said that's going to increase until it's bright shining and everything is revealed. So let's look at these small beginnings. What did Jesus have to say about his return? His disciples asked him, they came to him privately saying, tell us, when shall these things be, and what will be the sign of your presence and the conclusion of the age? So they asked him point blank, tell me when it's going to be. And that's the question that all of us want. Tell me a date. They asked for two things, but they also asked for signs. And so we see two aspects here. He's going to give you a time aspect, and he's also going to give you events. So you've got both. Now, not everyone's going to fully comprehend either, but in combination, they paint a powerful picture and a really conclusive result. Let's see if you agree. The other thing that's very important is he links together when he says, what will be the sign of your presence? And he's connecting these two things together and the conclusion of the age. Other renderings, the end of the age. So he's saying the Lord's presence and the end of the age are married inseparably. They cannot be separated. So don't be confused. And that helps us a lot because then when we see end of the age prophecies and we see things about the Lord's return, we understand that they coincide and talk about the same period. And this is the scripture that helps tie those things intricately together by Jesus' own words. So they're linked. And that helps us in proving that the Lord is present. Now when you talk about the Lord's return, you know, we talk about Matthew 24 as Bible studies. We all think about Daniel 12 chapter because they're interwoven. And so we're going to look back at Daniel and see what he has to say. Daniel 12:1, and at that time shall Michael, we all know who Michael is, shall stand up, and there shall be a time of trouble. Second verse, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. We believe this is talking about the resurrection of the sleeping saints. A second work after he arrives. Then Daniel 12:4, it says, Daniel shut up the words and sealed the book until the time of the end. This is confusing. Why are you saying shut it up? You just told me all this good stuff. Now you're saying shut it up? But he says, shut it up and it wouldn't be understood until the time of the end. So if this is the end time and we have an understanding of it, it links the two together that this must be that time. And he gives us some signs. He says, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. So we want to keep a number of these things in mind. He talked about the raising of the sleeping saints. He talked about the end time. He talked about running to and fro and knowledge. Let's keep those in mind. Now, if we look at many other places, and we don't have time to cover them all, there are a number of signs associated with the Lord's second presence and the end time. We're going to list some of them here. So we're going to look at the time of trouble, the increase of knowledge, running to and fro, regathering of Israel, annihilation threat, and a wise and faithful servant who he would find when he, Perkamai, when he arrives. He would find him when he was present. So he would arrive and he would find the servant there. And then there are some more veiled processes, and these are a little more difficult to prove without the spiritual mind. The end time, Bible chronology, raising of the sleeping saints, the gospel going worldwide, many deceivers, and as in the days of Noah. And so we're going to look at all of these and say, well, can we prove that the Lord is present? And we're going to look at the Bible. We're going to look at prophetic utterances. We're going to look at chronology a little. We're going to look at science. We're going to look at history. And you can judge for yourself whether we can prove that this event has happened, and that the Lord has arrived and is present. Prove all things. Once again, our Daniel 12:1. At that time, Michael shall stand up. Which is really giving us an indication that he's going to return and assume power. You know, he's sitting, he's waiting, but now he's standing up, he's assuming power, and he's doing something. We'll talk about what he's doing. In Daniel 12:9 through 12, we read, the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. None of the wicked shall understand it, but those that are wise will understand it. And then blessed is the one who waits and reaches out to the end of the 1,335 days. So it's giving us a number here. It's talking about days. Let's explore that just a little bit. Now in Daniel, there are a number of time prophecies. We're going to look at three of them. We're really going to look at two of them in detail, but we want to expose you to it. And it says that the words were going to be closed up until the end time. But at the end time, what was going to happen? They would understand. So do we understand something about this chronology? There's three sets of years or days related in Daniel. The 1260, the 1290, and the 1335. Now many of us, chronology is not our favorite subject. But we're going to try to give you a clear and concise explanation and visual picture of how it works. So that we can say, you know, this does or doesn't show this. And one of the keys came out in a book that was published in 1852. I saw a copy of it at Jim Parkinson's home. And it was published by a man named Elliot. And it had a chronology. And what was different than all the other chronologies before this, because there were numerous Second Advent chronologies, what was distinct about this was he had all of these periods starting on the same date. And that was a new concept. This was the earliest that we found that this was published. Later, Barber expanded on this, and Pastor Russell, of course, did as well. And so the important point was the chronologies, these periods all started on the same time. They ended on different times, and it was different events. And that's real key. And we'll show you how we can prove that. In Daniel 12:7, it talks about, it shall be for a time, times, and half, and then will shall be accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people. All these things will be finished. Well, this is encrypted language. The holy people that we're talking about is those that declare themselves to be the holy people, the false church system. And so it's saying that the false church system is going to be scattered and their power is going to be decreased significantly. And that's going to be at a period after time, times, and half the time. So what does that mean? We'll help you out just a little. In Hebrew, a time represents a year. And in the Hebrew calendar, it's not 365 days a year, but 360. So if we take this and we say a time is singular, that's 360. Times is plural, that's 720. And half a time would be 180. We come up with 1,260 years. And elsewhere in Scripture, we have this translated, I believe it's in Revelation, to months. So we have a correspondence that says, yeah, this is the right figure. You're not just pulling it out of the air. What happened that was the most calamitous thing that's ever happened in the Catholic Church? It happened in 1799 when the Pope died in captivity and they weren't allowed to, because they were under Napoleon, they weren't allowed to crown another Pope. And so for a period, this is called the darkest period in the Catholic Church by their own admission. And so let's use that date and see if that will help us define the starting point. Remember we said they had the same starting point for all of these. So if we take 1799 and go back 1260 years, that brings us to the year 539 AD. So what happened then? Well, what happened was very subtle. Remember we had the small seed that grew into something larger? Subtle beginnings. What happened was Justinian, the emperor of Rome, remember they were transitioning and moving into the eastern region? And so they were losing control of the whole Italian peninsula. And Justinian, the general, enlisted the Ostrogoths to help evict the current tribe that was corrupting things, which was the Vandals. So he had one tribe run another tribe out. They enlisted them. That's what happened just prior to this. And then things still were out of control because then the Ostrogoths were the new bad guys on the block. So Belisarius, a general, came in to basically rout them and move them out of the Italian peninsula. But he was recalled in 539 AD. This is a small seed. So he was recalled. That left a power void. Who was there? Well, we all know in Rome, the seat of the papal power was there. And so they assumed this and they helped to govern this area. And so it was their first inroad into papal power that they have never let go of since. And so this was that very modest beginning that occurred in 539 AD. Now, if we know that's 539 AD, now we know the starting point. So now we can figure out where the 1260, the 1290, and the 1335 go. So we kind of work backwards, but we're trying to do it logically. We're thinking with our left brains, right, Tim? Okay. I'm sorry, you're not going to get a lot of right brain here. In Daniel 12:12, blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1300, the 300, the 1,305 and 30 days. 1,335 years. That's what I was trying to say. So if we know the starting point, then we can go forward, and that would send us to what? The Lord's return. Now, where do you get the Lord's return out of this? We'll give you just a little hint. Remember small beginnings and little nuances. We have another scripture in Matthew 21, verse 9. And this is when Jesus was coming in. And what did they say? Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he who comes in the name of Jehovah, the Lord. Who was that? That was Jesus. So, blessed is he is a key phrase. And so what we find is that blessed and he is a linkage in both of these. It helps to give us a clue as to what this blessedness thing is that's coming, who waiteth and cometh at the 1,335 years. And the second thing that's important is the verbiage. It says it links them to coming. Now this again is a very subtle thing. So on its own you can't go to sweeping conclusions, but you will see that we will have other things that will tie into these dates and lock it in even further. So we'll check that off. We associated it with the end time and with the first clue of Bible chronology. There are others that we'll show you. In Daniel 12:1 it says, there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation, even down to that time. So it's talking about bad times. Now, what are the characteristics of these? This trouble? It's a trouble unlike anything in the past. Does the world recognize this trouble? Yes. The world recognizes things are really on shaky ground. Is the trouble worldwide? Absolutely. There's no corner on the earth where they can get away from it. Is the threat to every single individual? Absolutely. There is no safe haven. And are things getting worse? Yeah, the picture is that things will get progressively worse. Does this qualify as the time of trouble? The situation we're in now, whether you look at nuclear, bioterrorism, pandemic flu, financial ruin, is there any place you can go in the world and escape these things? The world has become a very small place. And in fact, for the first time in history, there's no place you can go to hide. It's worldwide. And that's something that's never happened since the beginning of time. I would say it matches this prophecy. So we'll give it a check mark. Let's look at technology advancements. And this was really, really interesting as I studied this out. Between about 1870 and 1890, the world as we know it changed from a technology standpoint in ways that had never been seen in the past. What we saw was an increase in sound, communications, light, power, multimedia, collaboration, mechanization, and transportation. And even though we look at these and go, these are all antique things, every single one of them is the basis of what we're doing here today. We have electricity, we all came here in cars, we listen to things, we have a sound system here, we're doing multimedia right now. Is there any one of these components that has not touched your life today? And the answer is no. In addition, the linotype and the mimeograph also came out. So there was an explosion in inventions that came together, and it changed the way life was. Now, we might pose a question, it's a valid one, how can you measure the increase of knowledge? And so I went out and searched, and there actually are measures. Now, a number of these measures are focused just on the United States, because the United States has this wonderful habit of keeping records. And so I wasn't able to do it for the entire world, but especially with transportation, we'll focus on the United States. But you'll get the point of what's happened. We'll look at the rate of knowledge doubling, the accumulation of recorded data, the smallest detectable object, the farthest detectable object, the number of heavenly objects, the smallest time record we can measure, which I'm told is an indication of the level of sophistication of technology for civilization, and finally, knowledge's impact on society. Let's look at the growth of knowledge. If we take the period from Adam to 1750, knowledge doubled in the next 150 years. So you got all those years from Adam down to 1750, that's one. It doubled again in 150 years, which is right at 1900, just before the period we're talking about. But what's happened since 1874? Let's see. Today, knowledge has exploded. We're told, you know, you can go out, and it's hard to get an exact source, but the current estimate is that knowledge now doubles every 2 years. 2 years. So we are learning things that we never were able to do before. We're into nanotechnology. We understand chemistry, physics, astronomy. The explosion is incredible to where all of us now are specialized people. There's no longer generalists because, you know, your job is very specific. So knowledge is increasing at an incredible rate, never seen before, and it's accelerating. Let's look at accumulated data. You know, in 1874, they had spoken communication, written and printed. Of course, in the garden, they had spoken. So we got a little better that you had recorded knowledge. But what's happened since then? Well, we've gone to electronic and today to collaborative. And collaborative is really what changed everything and made it really take off. Because now, virtually, you can have a project where you work with people around the world on a project. And that was never possible before, but the technology allows it. And it allows these ideas to be exchanged at an ever-increasing rate. And so today, data grows. The amount of recorded data goes up by a factor of 20 times every year, which is phenomenal. So there's much more stuff being recorded, and it goes beyond just text, as everyone knows. There's a lot of video and other stuff. So this data accumulation across the globe has gone up just astronomically. 20 times each year. So if it's one this year, it's 20 times more next year, it's 20 times 20 next year, and so on and so forth. And the experts say there's no end in sight. If you wonder why, think about your video camera and all the other things that we do, the electronic pictures that are megapixels and so forth, that is included with this accumulated data. The smallest detectable object is also a measure of technology. Of course, in the garden, it was 1x. It was the eyeball. In 1874, they could see about 1,000 times magnification. So you could see little, micro animals and so forth and small features. But that was it. Today, we have the atomic force microscope. It can see 700 billion times on a magnification. This is a picture actually of silicon dioxide molecules. So we are seeing atoms and molecules now. Did something change since 1874? Small beginnings, remember. Let's look at the farthest detectable objects. In 1874, they could see somewhere between 10 and 100 light years, and that was about it. They had no concept either of, they didn't really know what stars were, and they didn't know really what things were outside of our solar system. So they didn't have this concept we do of the universe. Today, we can see 13 billion light years back. 13 billion light years away. Has something changed? We can see back to close to the start of the universe. Wow. In the beginning. The number of objects that we can see in the sky. Of course, if you went out on a clear night, you could see about 10,000 stars if it was very clear out. In 1874, they had a thing called a galaxy theory. They were theorizing that there was this thing called galaxies. Of course, when they looked up and saw the Milky Way, they didn't realize that was the fulfillment of that. But they didn't realize there were other galaxies. Today we estimate that there are 100 billion galaxies. And by the way, this is conservative. In looking at figures, some people said up to 400 billion. The reason we can't tell is we haven't had time to count them. But they know based on the density of every place they've looked in the sky that we're talking about hundreds of billions of galaxies. And each one of those has about 100 billion stars. Oh, remember, by the way, that God has named every single one of them. He's really good at names. Let's look at the smallest time increments. And as I said, this is a sign of the level of technology of the civilization. In 1874, 1 second increments was about it, and the most accurate clock would lose about a second every 5 days. And these were the chronometers that were used for navigation on the seas. They were like the most accurate clocks. What about today? Today, not 5 years ago, I had to redo this, we have a mercury ion clock. It is accurate within 1 times 10 to the negative 18. That's 18 zeros. It loses 1 second every 400 million years. Does this seem like overkill to any of you? Is there really a need to do this? How many of you have a GPS in your car? Or have a GPS? You know, they're wonderful, aren't they, right? They tell you where you are and where to go. Kind of like having an extra wife. That thing is possible because of the accuracy of the clocks. And if they can move this technology into that GPS satellite system, they can be accurate to within millimeters of your position anywhere on the planet. That's the importance of this. That and computers. So this is a sign of technology. Let's look at the rate of changes between, we said, you know, Adam to 1874 was the one period. Really, we saw not much change. What we saw was knowledge has grown by a factor of 6,000 times since then. Data growth is growing by a factor of 14,000 times more. The smallest object has grown by 700 million times. The farthest object has grown by 1.3 billion times more. The number of objects has grown by 100 billion times. And time accuracy has been increased by 292 billion times. Now the question I can pose to you, do you think anything has changed in this last 100 plus years? Science would say yes. Knowledge has exploded. What's the impact of knowledge on society? You know, we had the hunter-gatherer era, the agricultural era, the industrial era, and then in 1990, something happened called the personal computer. When that thing got on the scene, life as we know it changed. But I look around and I see a number of computers here. Life has changed. And that we began with biotech agriculture. We had smart machines, we got computers, we got nanotechnology, we globalized, everything's interconnected, we're all networked. Life has changed. The internet goes right along with us during this time frame. In fact, today we are called the information age. And that started a little less than 20 years ago. So what's the evidence? Has knowledge been increased? Absolutely. The scientific record, there is absolutely no doubt. It's black and white. And these are only some of the measures. There are other measures as well. What about running to and fro? Now this one, the U.S. government helped me out. And all of these figures are going to be for the United States because they're the only ones that have tracked this over time accurately. But we're going to look at a number of factors. In 1874, 50 to 100 miles an hour, that was about as fast as you could go. A fast horse is 38 miles an hour. The speed record for a boat, 317, bullet train, 363, and so on and so forth. The fastest thing is a rocket that goes 158,000 miles an hour. Have things changed? Yeah. In fact, this speed is the basis of our high-tech global market, right? I can send it and overnight it to San Francisco or Japan or whatever. We have the need for speed. That's integral to the way that we do business. So maximum speeds increase significantly. When we look at 1874, it's really at the very infancy of vehicles, and I've been very liberal and said there might have been 1,000 of them, but that's pretty liberal. Yeah. When we look at today, we have 475,000 trains, 250 million motor vehicles, and 230,000 planes, for a total of more than 250 million motor vehicles or powered vehicles versus 1,000. Have things changed? Infrastructure, very key, and we're going to just look at paved miles of highway. This is actually the figure from 1900. Was 4 miles of paved highway. Today, you notice I had to move it over, in the United States alone, 4 million miles of paved highways. Explosive highway growth. In fact, one of the big political issues now is how do we support our infrastructure. We did it, and now we've got to keep it up. And that's a big problem. The bridges are falling down, the roads are falling down. How do you maintain 4 million miles? And remember, this is the United States. We're not counting the rest of the world. Passenger miles. How many of you walked here today? I dare say nobody unless you were camping here. So there was less than 1,000 vehicles in 1874, so there weren't many passenger miles. Let's see what it is today. 55 trillion miles on train, 4.9 quadrillion miles in motor vehicles, 580 trillion in air. And this is the annual rates, by the way. This is not accumulated. So this is what we do today. Has something changed? So we do a total of 5.5 quadrillion miles per year in the United States alone. I'm glad I don't get that gas bill. It's really a key to our civilization, though. Everything is, now that we virtualize things, I expect it to be delivered to my door. I expect to go wherever I need to. I expect to get on a plane and come to Jackson, Michigan, and give a talk, and then go back to Florida the next day. That's kind of the expectation. So let's look at a summary of what's happened with transportation. Well, speed has increased by a factor of 3,000 times since 1874. The number of vehicles has gone up by 1 million times. Remember, again, I'm trying to be conservative on these. The roads have gone up by a factor of 1 billion times more road. Passenger miles have gone up by 5.5 quadrillion times. Bottom line is travel is integral to our life. It's no longer an option. When we lose our cars, we're in a dilemma. We have to have transportation in today's world. It's absolutely critical. I'm also reminded of what happened in one man's lifetime. In the late 60s, my grandfather was born in the late 1890s. And I was talking to him prior to his death. And I said, you know, what have you seen in your lifetime? He said, Bobby, he said, I've seen us go from horse and buggy to landing on the moon. And he made a statement. He said, in no one else's lifetime has so much change occurred. That stuck in my mind. And in context of this, I'm saying, you went from walking or horse and buggy to landing on the moon. That's the reality of what change has happened. Are we running to and fro? By all measures, absolutely. So we're going to check that one off. We're also told that Israel would regather, that a remnant would come out of all countries. And so we see a progression starting from 1878, very modest beginning. Once again, that little tiny seed, the Berlin Congress of Nations, Petit Tikva, Balfour Accord, the Holocaust, the fishing and the hunting, the nationhood in 1948, Jerusalem in its own place, 1967, and the immigration of the Jews from Russia for the first time in almost 100 years from Russia, because the borders, the wall went down. All of these things were predicted to happen while the Lord was present. Let's look again at chronology. We'll talk about the double. When we look at this in Jeremiah, it says, I will first recompense their iniquity and their sin double. It's in two. In Zechariah 9:12, it says, I declare that I will render double unto thee. So these kind of agree with each other that there's going to be a double process. And when we look at that, that's Mishnah. It's a double portion. So he's going to give them one portion and then another. But my question to you is, are those equal portions? Is there something we can surmise from this? And the answer is yes. We're told in Genesis 49:28 that he would bless them. And then it says in Isaiah 40, verse 2, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all of her sins. And this is the second portion. Now, what's that word? It's the word kepel, which means to fold in half. So now you define the period, and the periods are equal. So we've got two periods that are equal, two portions that would be divided. And what was going to happen? It started when it said, we had the blessing period, and then we continued when he said, your house is left unto you what? Desolate. Let's see if that works. Spiritual Israel's perspective of the double of Israel. Well, it starts at Jacob's death. That was really when the 12 tribe nation began, right? And we put that about 1813 BC. We have Jesus' death at 33. Now, if we take that, that is a period of 1845 years. Some of you will question my math, but with regards to the calendar, there is no year zero, so you got to take another year out of there. We went from BC 1 to AD 1. There was no zero. Don't get upset about that. So we have 1845 years. So if we had a period of blessing, that ended what? At the cross. And then we had what? A period of desolation. So we add 1845 years. What happened then? Well, this is the date that we believe the sleeping saints were raised. And remember in Daniel 12:2, it talked about them that sleep in the grave would come up, arise. It's an allusion to that. Of course, we also have that in Revelation as well. So we have this double. So the Lord was almost already present because he was already doing this work. Remember, that was the first thing that he said he would do after he arrived, was to raise the sleeping saints. Let's see how else that works. Does that also point to the Lord's return? Well, Jesus was raised in 33 AD. When did he start his ministry? When did he arrive on the scene as an adult full of age? Well, that was 29 AD. And so if that was his first advent, and we take the 1845, that would make his second advent in 1874, which is another date that we heard before, right? So we have two dates that actually line up and agree with each other, showing his first and his second advent. So the double also harmonizes with the 1874 date. And then there's also a natural perspective of the double, once again starting in 1813, and ending with the establishment of the nation of Israel. So let's just say, let's take that, let's calculate how many years that is, 3,760 years, and let's divide it in half and see if that also shows a double portion. Well, that would be 1,880 years for each half. So if we go forward and backward, they both come to the same year, 68 A.D. And what happened in 68 A.D.? Well, then the Jews were forcibly dispersed from the land. Does this agree? Boy, it seems to line up nicely, doesn't it? So Israel is restored during the period of the second presence. And all of these things work together so nicely. So we're going to check off Israel. We have an annihilation threat. And we all know that we are in this period where we not only hear about wars and rumors of wars, but we're involved in it. And really, these are global wars, and that started with, as was said, the Great War, or World War I. It continued with World War II. It continued with the Cold War, that ended in about 91. Now we have the War on Terrorism, which is, according to the experts, supposed to go on for another 20 years until some period in the future when the four winds will be fully loosed in the four corners of the earth. And so for the first time, mankind faces worldwide annihilation. And from 1953 to 61, the U.S. increased their nuclear weapons from 1,000 to 18,000. The last figure I found said they still have 10,000 nuclear warheads. And this was to enforce a policy called MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction, which said if I shoot them off and you shoot them off, we're all dying. So none of us are going to shoot them off because that's too bad. But that's the MAD scenario. Does this qualify? Unless those days be shortened, no flesh should survive. And by the way, there's no safe place to go. So we'll check that off. We look at prominent servants. It says that there's going to be a servant there. And when we look back in the 1874 period, we find three prominent preachers that were preaching this Second Advent message, Barbara Russell and Patton. But what happened in 1879? Well, there was a falling out over the ransom. And so what happened was two of those fell out and one remained. Now, we're told that this would be a wise and faithful servant who he would find doing things when he came, and he would make him ruler over all of his goods. What happened? According to Charles Russell's own words, I've been a Bible student since I first had attention called to the second coming of the Lord by our Second Advent preacher. And then he continues. In 1874, for the first time, Charles Russell understood the meaning of baptism, with the result that he symbolized his consecration to the Lord by being immersed. And then in 1878, he began writing the pamphlet, The Object and the Manner of the Lord's Return. Isn't this exactly what we would expect of a wise and faithful servant? And he had characteristics. We had the timing of the servant. He was to write down the vision. He was to give weekly season. He was to be a prolific writer with an inkhorn in his hand. And he was to be faithful unto death. And by all accounts, he met all of these criteria. So we'll check that off. Next, we see the gospel of the kingdom is supposed to go worldwide and to be preached into all nations. And we see that it started, it's been in the United States, Europe, parts of the Middle East, Asia, India, Africa, and continues to spread even onto this day. We now have brethren in Japan, in Korea, there's an interest in China, in the Philippines, in parts of Africa that have not been touched before, and it's going to the four corners of the earth, exactly as was supposed to happen when the Lord was present. We're told that it would be a time when there would be many deceivers, and there would be many corrupt things happening in churchianity. And as we look at this laundry list of what's happened in the last 20 years, we realize that the systems are rife with corruption, just as predicted they would be. We're also told it would be as in the days of Noah, that people would just have this attitude, life goes on. They're not really aware or in tune with God, and they're oblivious to the situation, although they're very nervous because they know we're in trouble. And so we see that these criteria as well have been met. Now, what's the purpose of the Lord's presence? Well, the first thing is he's in the process of demolishing these systems. It's kind of like an excavation. You've got to clear it off before you can rebuild. And that's what's happening right now. That's what's distressing to each and every human being on the earth, as we see the systems that have been developed. There's no safe place, there's no security, and things are going downhill. We also know that he promised there would be a regathering of Israel, and we see that process continuing even unto today. And then on a more spiritual plane, the resurrection of the sleeping saints and the gathering of what he calls as the elect, or the final footstep followers. So what does the evidence show about the Lord's return? Well, we have times and we have signs. And so we've got the whole picture. But we're warned also that there would be scoffers in the last time saying, where's the promise of his presence? And so we have to be watch and wait and be vigilant. Now as watchers and waiters, we're promised blessings. Blessed are those servants whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find watching. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, and the wise, this brethren class, shall understand. And then he says, Matthew 25. Remember, we were mostly in Matthew 24. Now in Matthew 25. Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Those are some of the blessings. Blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. Because not many are privileged to hear and to see these things. What should our response be? Well, first we're warned to come out of the false systems, that we be not partakers of her sins and receive not of her plagues. Further, we're told, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together, especially as these troubling times come. It's ever more important to gather together. And that's exactly the opposite of what the flesh would say in trying times. And we're told to stay fervent. He wishes that we were neither hot nor cold. He doesn't want us to be lukewarm. He wants us to be hot and fervent. And finally, he says, watch ye therefore and pray always that ye be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. When you see all of these things happening, he says, and when these things come to pass, then look up and lift your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. What a beautiful picture. What a beautiful truth. We rejoice in the fact that the Lord is present, and he is working out all these things for the ultimate blessing of all the world of mankind, that they might glorify God through all eternity. For from him and through him and to him are all things. To God be the glory forever. Amen.